The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Hey folks, before the podcast starts, I want to tell you about an event. You can celebrate the end of the work week at the Museum of Science and Industry, Chicago. Tickets are on sale now for MSI After Hours, the Second City Comedy Lab. On Friday, September 8th, from 7 to 10 at night, enjoy a cocktail and get exclusive access to more than a dozen of MSI's hands-on exhibits. Plus, hang out with the actors from the Second City during comedy workshops and watch cast members and MSI insiders come up with one-of-a-kind improv show about science, robotics, and little-known artifacts. Visit msichicago.org/afterhours to buy your tickets. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Ai-Zhen Poo. Ai-Zhen is the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations, a national coalition of 200 advocacy organizations working to transform the long-term care system for aging Americans, people with disabilities, and their caregivers. She is the author of The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. She serves on numerous boards, including her recent appointment as a member of the Board of Trustees for the Ford Foundation. She's a 2014 recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant and has been working with the Second City over the last year to develop an improvisation for caregivers program. Ai-Zhen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be with you.
All right. In the 2 years that we've known each other, and we know each other, and especially in the last year as we've been working together to develop this new program around improvisation for caregivers, I remain astounded that you have dedicated your life's work to the most difficult conversations, to matters of life and death, literally, to problems that seem insurmountable. But through all of that, you like really laugh a lot.
I love to laugh. And also being around you, it brings out the joy.
Oh, well, I like that. Though, in your book, you talk a lot about crediting your grandmother because you said that she said, quote, every time you laugh, you extend your life an extra day. So you may as well laugh a lot.
My grandmother has the best laugh. It's every time I even think of it, it makes me smile. She's one of those people that believes that if you laugh really hard 3 times a day, you'll just live a really healthy life and drop dead when you want to. Like, it'll just be perfect.
And in fact, there's a little science to that, too, I think, that they've done around, you know, happiness and laughter and extending people's lives. And in India, they have sort of laughing clubs, and those people all seem to live longer than we do.
Yep. No, I believe it. And most things she says are true.
All right. So we got a ton to talk about. But one of the things I want to start with is a different mindset around aging. And I'm going to quote you from your book. You say, quote, we receive constant messages that subtly and not so subtly diminish older people in American culture. So what's going on there?
I think we have this really deeply held cultural belief or orientation that aging is about decline and decay. And we associate aging with dying and diminishing in our power, in our agency, in our voice. And I think a lot of it is actually subconscious. Mm-hmm. But it shows up everywhere. And I think what it does is it leaves all of this opportunity on the table, especially as we extend our lives and advances in healthcare and medicine let us live 20 years longer than we had thought we would just a few generations ago. We have this whole other actual kind of generation that we get to live. And if we associate that whole time with decline and decay and loss, just imagine how much opportunity and potential gets left on the table. And so what we're trying to do is just uncover the ways that that cultural belief around that association with aging and decline how we can start to uncover it so that we can transform it.
And it's interesting, too, because it's you know, it's very present in pop culture, and it's very present in our movies and TV and other conversations. And it tends to be the people who are aging who are perpetuating it, and it's not the kids. Because I just know, like, my kids, their experience with their grandparents was like, that's all they wanted to do is hang out with them. And so what happens, you know, when we grow up, and I imagine it's our fear of our own mortality and fear of our own death, that we just want to avoid it or push it away. And then that ends up making it stigmatized, right?
That's right. We have fear of death and dying. We have a fear of disability and fear of loss of agency. But I think you're right. It's like I grew up with my grandparents, and I can't imagine who I would be without their influences in my life. And the very particular wisdom that comes from the experience and perspective that comes from just having walked the earth for longer and done more for longer. And I think that, you know, it's I don't know when it happens to us, but at a certain point we start to shift. But I actually think that that's starting to change. When I look at what's happening in pop culture, I'm starting to see more movies like The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel or more shows like Grace and Frankie, show with the Jane Fonda and
Lily Tomlin.
And it's really, I think I'm seeing more and more stories where older people are fully living.
Right.
Living not the same life that they lived, right, 20, 30 years before, but fully living.
Right. I like also that you're making this attempt to change the very simple language and the way we talk about it, because you actually call it an elder boom.
Yes, right. So, you know, a lot of people are starting now to talk about this this change in our demographics that has to do with the baby boom generation aging and turning 65 at a rate of 10,000 people per day. This massive generation starting to turn 65 and reach retirement age. And because advances in medicine have allowed us to live longer than ever, we're about to have the largest older population we've ever had in this country. And it's going to really increase the need for care and support in order for people to live well. And so there's all kinds of concerns and ways in which having more people living longer actually changes a lot about the way that we live and work in this country. So people have started to become aware of it and call it the silver tsunami. Like there are all these words that refer to natural disasters.
Right, the gray wave.
Epic natural disasters. And I call it the elder boom because I do feel like there is a opportunity in it. And if we look at it like an opportunity, a lot of ways it's a very improv philosophy of like, what is the opportunity inside of this thing that people are afraid of?
Yeah, well, you say, quote, people getting older is not a crisis, it's a blessing. Absolutely true. Absolutely. And mostly I want to talk with you about ideas and stories because I think that's very effective. But we should pause on the numbers. And I wrote down some numbers, and I think that's just important for certain people to get a grasp on this. And you just threw one out there that I've used, and people are sort of like, really? Which is 10,000 people are turning 65 every single day for the next 20 years?
Every 8 seconds, someone turns 65.
In this country?
In this country.
Just this country?
Just this country.
All right. Like, I mean, that is an astounding number. And especially, you know, and we can get political. We don't need to get political. But when you talk about, like, oh, let's not have immigrants coming in, who's caring for these older people?
I mean, that's one example. It was like, it's actually impossible to imagine how we care for all of these older people who deserve really good care without a really strong immigrant workforce.
Okay, some more numbers. 3.5 million seniors now live in poverty.
Yeah. It's astounding.
All right. Come on. We'll need at least 1.8 million additional home care workers in the next decade.
Absolutely.
So just talking about that, like that's 1.8 million jobs that are open and available and not going to be filled by the, you know, 25-year-old white guy who's out there, you know, yelling about something.
Right.
Yeah. By 2050, individuals needing long-term care and personal assistance is projected to grow from 12 million to 27 million.
And that's a conservative estimate.
Okay. And the last number I've got is 44.4 million Americans are providing unpaid care. What's going on there?
we're talking about people. It's actually now the more recent numbers are 52 million working age adults who are actually in the workforce working full time jobs who are providing 20 hours or more of care for family members per week. So that's like job upon job.
Right.
And doing it without any support or really any recognition or visibility. It's really, it's, people are caring a lot, especially this generation of people we call the sandwich generation, right? Mm-hmm. The people who have both elder care responsibilities and young children. It's like the panini effect of being panini squeezed between the pressures of care on both ends of the generational spectrum.
Okay. So let's talk about our stuff, because I think it's about this.
It is.
So to sort of like level set, the way we know each other is classic in that Adam Grant, who's been on the podcast, is a friend of yours, and you were moving to Chicago, and he's like, you guys should get together. And this is what Adam does and expects nothing in return, because he wrote the great book Give and Take, which is about this. And we had one of these like great lunches, and we're sort of like, oh, we're working at interesting things. Like, I don't know about this world, and I don't know how much you knew about my world. But what we've discovered over now the year or two that we've known each other is that they are connected. Because if you're talking about taking care of people, taking care of yourself, in improvisation, that's the orientation. The orientation is, you know, how am I taking care of myself? And by taking care of myself, I need to take care of others. So one of the things that the elements that we talk about with regard to the sort of caregiving community is in improvisation, we talk about creating ensembles.
That's right.
Right. And this is very important because it's not just like teams that get disbanded. Ensembles are behaviors and rules and ideas that govern the way that we're going to exist with each other in a space. You had a quote from Gail Sheehy in your book that said, quote, the secret of caregiving success is that we cannot do it alone. No one can. We must create a support circle, a circle of care. That's an ensemble.
It's an ensemble. And the idea of ensemble in the improv context is so powerful and so perfect in the caregiving context, because what we're talking about in caregiving is it can't be a zero-sum game. Basically, what we're talking about is a situation it's all hands on deck. We need family members. We need friends and neighbors. There's a role for government. There's a role for companies. There's a role...
Doctors, nurses.
Mm-hmm. Nurses. And the more we function as an ensemble, the better outcomes for everyone. As long as we start to see what each other brings to the table and really invest in each other's roles and the relationships between our different roles, the better the outcomes are for the people who are being supported and cared for, the more you save the healthcare system money, you create a better job environment for a worker. I mean, anyone who's ever hired a home care provider for a loved one knows that just because you hire somebody in your home doesn't mean you don't then have a role to play. Mm-hmm. You actually still are in it. You're in it with that caregiver. You are a caregiver. You're managing that care. You're coordinating it. You're thinking about it. And everyone, the more we act and plan as ensembles in this environment, the better it is for everyone. In an already complicated landscape of emotions and finances and all this stuff, the most important thing we can do is like be with each other.
And I think it's really important for people to understand, especially folks who've listened to the podcast a bunch, because we talk about this all the time, is we are not culturally oriented towards this.
That is right.
We are oriented towards the soul creative, the magic individual, the stoic one person, John Wayne. Like, it's just me. I'm going to do it. Bruce Willis in Die Hard. I'm going to do it. Donald Trump. I'm the one to take care of your problems. That is all bullshit. It is not true. And we talk about it in an advertising context with these creative directors who make millions of dollars. And it's like, really, one guy is going to come up with every idea? This is not how it works. And so it is no different in business than it is in our personal lives, because we take these stories and these myths that get handed down and that we see on screens, and we just sort of, we wear them like it's true. And what we've discovered over our time at Second City is the minute that you put someone in an ensemble orientation where they, whether they want to or not, they have to use the language, they have to do the behaviors and all that, lo and behold, they start working together better. And I love this quote. You said we need a super friends approach to caregiving.
That's right.
And that's like
that's
like,
an ensemble. Exactly.
That's
an ensemble.
That's like the best Second City group or any ensemble that you think about, a symphony or a you know a baseball team or whatever. So I love that idea. Another quote I found, which I thought was great, was quote: "The more we practice being allies to seniors, people with disabilities, and those members of our communities who rely on personal assistance and care both in and outside the home, the more fully human we will become."
That's right. I mean, the thing about the caregiving experience is I really am a believer in this quote from Rosalind Carter. She says that there are only four kinds of people in the world: people who are caregivers or will be caregivers, people who need care or will need care. And usually we're more than one of those identities
at any given time.
And so this whole notion of the kind of connectivity that is so core to improv, where you just, at all costs, you stay connected in your ensemble, right?
Yeah.
It really, it's so helpful in the caregiving context to just understand that if you're providing care, you're going to need care. You could need care tomorrow, and it's about cultivating that sense of empathy and connection.
Right, and we're fighting the enemy of isolation.
That's right.
I mean, and this is the human condition. We're taping this a couple days after Hurricane Harvey has hit.
That's right.
And as terrible as the world is right now, the amount of people who are coming together to help each other has been great.
Yes.
And that's what I'm seeing is people not allowing people to be isolated in this.
That's right.
And that's a good story.
That is a good story. And it reminds me, and I think we're going to start to hear more of these stories as the days pass, but during Hurricane Sandy, a lot of the people who were stuck were older people in high rises when the power went out. Mm-hmm. And you're on the 14th floor in a high rise that's elevator dependent. A lot of the people who were stuck were people with disabilities and older adults.
Sure.
And their caregivers.
Yeah.
And their caregivers also had families who were stuck and who were out of power and were in dangerous situations. So the caregivers were often in a position of having to decide between their own families and the people who they cared for. And one of the most amazing stories that we heard coming out of Hurricane Sandy was the caregiver who basically went and got her 10-year-old daughter from her school and brought her to the high rise where mm-hmm. the elderly person that she cares for lives. And they stayed there for a week together. Hmm. The 10-year-old, the 89-year-old woman with Alzheimer's, and the caregiver. And they sewed together, they cooked together, they took care of each other in this way that they expanded the ensemble in the moment of crisis, which is, I suppose, what we should always do.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think the thought we hear a lot is, you know, like, well, if things get really serious, like crisis, that's when you don't want to be improvising, when exactly the opposite is true. That is when we have to improvise.
Right.
So the studies that have been done, and Carl Weick at the University of Michigan is chief among them, looks at the way that aircraft carriers utilize improvisation, which is so high risk. But there's split-second changes that need to occur. And if you don't have the personal agency to allow yourself to make that change and to do it in concert with others who are listening to you, people are going to die.
That's right.
So you know, we're not saying, like, make it up at all given times. What we're saying is practice the ability to improvise and have agency for when things get difficult, because that's where you need to be able to draw on that stuff.
That's exactly right. And, you know, on this point, coming back to your earlier thread around aging and how we really change our approach to it culturally, this idea of living longer being a blessing, I just want to say that I really do, if you think about it, longer to live is longer to learn, to contribute, mm-hmm. to connect, to be with your families, to do the things you love. It's longer to do a lot of things that make us who we are if we have the right supports.
Right.
And it's so much about the ensemble.
Right, right.
And
'cause not everyone has that support.
Exactly. Exactly.
One of my favorite things is to follow Carl Reiner on Twitter, famous comedian, Dick Van Dyke Show, many stuff. But he and Mel Brooks get together and watch movies every night. And these men are in their 90s. And they are contributing. And Mel still tours, and they have point of view, and they're funny. And it's like I'm so happy to live in a world where these two old men have each other.
That's right.
But they also are older white men who were highly successful, had money, all that. They had all the support systems, and most people don't have that.
Right. No, it's true. That's why I think we have to really be creative about how we invest in these caregiving relationships and create the systems and supports that can help people afford the care that they need, get access to quality care, especially in rural parts of the country where there isn't a whole lot of infrastructure and aren't a whole lot of resources in the healthcare system. We have to really invest and think this through.
Okay, one of the other sort of improvisational principles that we're playing with and adapting in our work is yes and. So, of course, that's what the podcast talked about. That's what my books talked about. But in this context, it's maybe going to be different for people. Can I give you to give a shot at explaining yes and in the context of caregiving?
Well, I would say the most fundamental yes and that led to the creation of the campaign that I lead with my colleague Sarita Gupta is called Caring Across Generations. The common wisdom is that you have this burden of caregiving and you can't do it alone, so you hire somebody to come and care, but it's expensive. And you can't afford it, and so you try to figure out how you can find the cheapest care possible, and you also really see the idea of higher wages and benefits and all the things that the caregivers need as sort of counter to your own interests. Like there's a scarcity mentality that wraps around. And it makes sense because it's a really hard situation to be in, a lot to manage, and it is very expensive. And the biggest yes and that we came to was that this actually isn't sustainable for anyone. It's not good for families. It's not good for workers. What we have to say is yes to the family who needs help supporting or affording care. We have to say yes to the worker. And if we say yes to both, what other possibilities open up? And what we've found is this amazing possibility of an ensemble of caregivers, professional caregivers, family caregivers, people in the healthcare system, and the people who need the support, seeing themselves as one.
Yeah, that's it. And when we started playing around with this idea, and my wife Ann Libra is very involved in this, and she talked a lot about and both.
And both, yes.
So it's not just yes and, it's like and both. Like so you have, let's talk about in the context of a situation where maybe someone has dementia, which is like you have this reality that you're living in, which is true, and it's both true that I'm in a different reality. So let's play with that. Let's play in this sort of new space. We don't have to just, you know, because so many people maybe go to blocking, you know, with this. And it turns out the science tells us that's not the right thing to do. So I know I've blown the yes and story in the middle. It's a new thing. I'm trying it. but the other thing, so I reread your book. This was my second read of it through. And it's amazing when you read it for having to talk to you, because I start to make all sorts of different discoveries that I didn't see the first time around. And I want to talk to you about women. And not from the book, but in a New York Times piece, you wrote, quote, women are often first responders. So let's start there, because I think that sums up a little bit of where we're going with this.
Interesting. Well, I love looking at the world through your eyes, Kelly. It's so fun. But what I was going to say is what I try to do is help people understand that when you look at the world, because of the particular role that the role that women are often playing in our lives, in our economy, in our families, We have a situation where more than half the paid workforce is women. Women are still doing a lion's share of all the caregiving work. They're more than half of the electorate, more than half of all of college graduates. The experiences of women are actually far from a special interest group. We're talking about an experience that's increasingly defining of the whole.
Yes.
And it's obviously not a monolithic experience, but it is this very 21st century defining experience. And if you put on almost like Google glasses, like if you put on glasses of the experience of someone who is doing a bunch of caregiving and doing work and going to school and managing care on both sides of the gender, when you look at the world through the eyes of women, you often see problems in 3D, like you see more dimensions of the challenges that we deal with in the world and potential for solutions.
Right.
Like you can actually, the women glasses oftentimes point the way towards unlikely pairings and new ways of imagining an ensemble, because you're seeing so many dimensions where women are knitting together and bridging across different experiences, different challenges in the economy, in our society, and having to solve for so many of those challenges for themselves and their families.
There's another I thought this was brilliant. In fact, I posted this on social media and a bunch of people were into it. You quote the economist Nancy Fober.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she says, and this is a little dense, but let go with me on this. Quote, "The common notion that we inhabit two disparate worlds, one in which we do things for love and one in which we do things for money, has some very perverse effects. It justifies a distinct lack of respect and remuneration for work that involves love, and also justifies the pursuit of naked self-interest when money is concerned. It's a very gendered distinction. Women are to love as men are to money." And I read some science not too long ago that says that the secret fear of men is that they can't provide, you know, financially for their care. And the secret fear of women is they can't do it all, which is kind of what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fucked up.
Mm-hmm. It's completely out of balance.
Yeah.
And I think when we think about gender equity, we think about a set of things, but we don't actually think about how we could bring the universe into greater balance, right? Because of that very simple dynamic that you just talked about.
Yeah. So first order of business, like, no, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also, I think, what's so fascinating about your work, because it's not just about like a thing we're doing, which is creating these sort of, you know, deep, interactive experiences for caregivers and other people in the medical community and all that. But this idea of changing the cultural conversation is something that you've played with by working with artists.
Yes.
Yeah.
And culture, you know, when we first start, I've been doing advocacy on issues and policy for a very long time. And one of the things that I realized early on is that it's possible to change policy. And when you lose the narrative, you haven't won.
Mm.
And so it's possible to win the policy, but when you lose the hearts and minds piece of the policy, you actually haven't won. It's incomplete. And that led me to actually think about this idea that we actually talk a lot about changing hearts and minds, and mostly what we know how to do is change minds.
Mm.
We don't actually invest in changing hearts. And the artists and the creatives and the people like you know about changing hearts. It's a different arena, fundamentally.
I had coffee this morning with Mike Slaby, who's been on the podcast before. He was Obama's CT. He did all the tech for the first Obama campaign. And he got in this very interesting conversation about Democrats are terrible because they keep pushing policy first. And it's like, no one, like, can we just agree that we should take care of each other? Does everyone agree with that? And very few people are going to say no to that. Okay, then if we all agree that, we're going to find the policy. And I remember this from the campaign, right? Everyone's like, but look at Hillary's like website. She has all these policy points. I'm like, no one cares.
No one's going to look at
They're
the
not
website.
Going to read it. They're not going to the website. What is she saying? How is she connecting?
Right.
And that tends to be, you know, we know this is true in theater and our work. And it's why when I want to talk to you about numbers, I specifically wanted to frame that as, all right, we're going to quickly do some numbers. But if I lingered on numbers the whole time, like, everyone is shut off. They don't want to hear that, but they will connect to when we understand these greater themes of what it means to be a woman in the world today and how that has changed. What does it mean to be a man in response to that? Because that's certainly something I struggle with, because I don't want to be like the modern day Phil Donahue, Alan Alda feminist guy. But at the same time, I don't want to like sit on the sidelines. So it's sort of like, okay, where and when do I weigh in and how do I help? And the lovely thing, I think, about our work and that we're trying to say is it's all of us all of the time.
That's right.
Sometimes you're going to need to press down the lever harder than I am. And the only way we know that is if we're all doing it together.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, there's this piece of – there's a way to understand the world that I think artists really are connected to in a way that a lot of other people aren't, which is to understand that there is a distinction between what is factually true and what is emotionally true for people. And both are true. Both actually matter. Mm-hmm. And what is emotionally true for people exists in the space of our emotional lives, which is irrational, unpredictable, unruly. But it is very defining of our lives,
yeah.
Right? Our emotional lives are really big in shaping who we are in the world. And if we don't account for that, and if we don't challenge ourselves to get into that tricky emotional space and then find the good in it, right?
Right,
and
right.
Really enhance the love, the care, the stuff that is the best of what being a human is in a lot of ways, then we leave all of that part of human life on the table that is, there's a lot of wisdom in there and there's a lot of potential to make positive change in the world.
And the good stuff is not going to come out of easy conversations.
That's right. Exactly.
You wrote a piece about 10 things progressives need to do now. And one of them was, quote, listen deeply to people who are different from us.
Yes. There needs to be a big round of listening happening right now.
Yeah. And that is going to require us to set aside a whole set of presumptions. Because, you know, as you know, we're doing this work at the University of Chicago around this. And it really is about us listening to you and seeing you as you see you.
Yes.
And that is different. That is different than just sort of like, that's different than empathetic listening, whatever. It's deeper than that. Because if I understand how you see you, which is different, that goes beyond gender and race, and it might have to do with what's your favorite television show, what you like to do athletically, what about your family bonds, all those things, right? Then we're in this whole other kind of area. But it does allow us then to connect.
Right.
Even if you believe fundamentally different things than I do.
It's critical that kind of listening happens right now. And it's my colleague Ishita, who you know, she said this brilliant thing the other day. She said, you know, I'm not sure about empathy because empathy still implies othering.
Yeah.
Right? I think I like love better because it doesn't.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I think some of what you're talking about, I don't know if you want to frame it this way, if we want people to do it, but, you know, that loving listening, right? Listening with love, maybe, you know, where you're not othering, you're really trying to be one. And this is the improv technique. You're really trying to be one with the person that you're listening to.
Yeah. And again, so there's practicality to this, which is the improv thing, because we're cynical about some of this stuff. Some people are very cynical about love because they've been hurt or, you know, they see so much hate or whatever in the world. And I get all that. The practice of improvisation simply says if you do it like this, if you just eliminate no and you say yes and enough, you're going to get better results with the person across from you. So, you know, you don't have to, like, believe it. And actually, I heard a scientist say, you know, there is some science behind faking it to make it. You know, and I think there's a little bit of what we're talking about, which is, like, we know it's difficult. We know you don't want to have the conversation. Let's build up some practices so you just have the conversation. Because I guarantee you, you're going to feel better afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and.
All right. And we normally end with a yes and story. We did it in the middle. I still feel good about that. I'm not going to judge myself, even though clearly I'm judging myself by talking about it. But before we close out, what are some other things that people can do to get on the bandwagon here?
Oh, great question. I love this question. You know, I think right now is this moment. If you want a concrete thing to do, you know, I don't know that this is the right answer, but what I will say is that I feel like we're living in a moment of history that only comes around every few generations, where what we're dealing with politically, I think, is a real existential threat to the moral fabric of this country and institutions of our democracy. And I think we owe it to our kids and our grandkids to take it seriously.
Hmm.
And to, when they ask us, which they will, mm-hmm. what we were doing in 2017, to have a good answer, right?
Hmm.
To be a part of the solution. And for some, that will mean listening with love. For others, it will be getting really involved in elections and encouraging the best people you know to run for office at any level and helping them win. For others, it will be marching when it's time to march. But I think whatever a good answer is for you, understanding that we have a unique role in this moment in history in preserving the best of our democracy, I think you should do that.
Right. It's a call to action. And if that action is that you're kind, that's a good action.
It is.
All right. Give me one other concrete example of a thing that people could do.
All right. Well, we need to celebrate because there's a really important holiday. The most important holiday that you've never celebrated is coming up. It's Grandparents' Day on September 10th. And the way we're asking you to celebrate is by honoring the people and the intergenerational relationships, like the one I have with my grandmother, that make everything else possible in our lives. And to actually go to postcards.care and upload a photo of your grandparent, and send those postcards will go to your senator to protect our health care and to also raise any other issues you want to raise about valuing and investing in the relationships that matter in our lives.
So you can go to caringacrossgenerations.com, right? Or is it .org?
.org, caringacross.org, and join what we call the caring majority.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of us that are caring and care about our future and making sure that each of us has the care we need to live well.
And I think we bought the domain Improv for Care when we were at Aspen, right?
Yes.
We were sitting outside and realized that we need a domain. We haven't built the website yet, but that will be a place where you're going to come to be able to get these kinds of programs. But for the time being, if you contact your organization or even mine at secondcityworks.com, we can you know, bring you into the fold.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for coming on, Aisha.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. You're the best.
Well, I've been working in a corner.